they were not only part of the rural and slave proletariat, working in rice, sugar, tobacco, and later cotton. From the beginning, they were part of this urban proletariat, and that black working class was there at the making of these American cities.
From the ongoing issues of poverty, health, housing, and employment, to the recent upsurge of lethal police-community relations, the black working class stands at the center of perceptions of social and racial conflict today. Journalists and public policy analysts often discuss the black poor as consumers rather than producers, as takers rather than givers, and as liabilities instead of assets. In his engrossing new history, Workers on Arrival, Joe William Trotter Jr. refutes these perceptions by charting the black working class's vast contributions to the making of America. Covering the last 400 years since Africans were first brought to Virginia in 1619, Trotter traces black workers' complicated journey from the transatlantic slave trade through the American century to the demise of the industrial order in the 21st century. At the center of this compelling, fast-paced narrative are the actual experiences of these African-American men and women, a dynamic and vital history of remarkable contributions despite repeated setbacks. Workers on Arrival expands our understanding of America's economic and industrial growth, its cities, ideas, and institutions, and the real challenges confronting black urban communities today. On today's Labor History in 2...
The year was 1974. That was the day that workers at Farrah Manufacturing finally ratified its first contract.
I'm Chris Garlock, and that's all ahead on this week's Labor History Today. Here's the show. Joe Trotter is professor of history at Carnegie Mellon University. He discussed his book Workers on Arrival last month at an Eastside Freedom Library History Book Club virtual event that was co-sponsored by the University of Minnesota's Department of History, the Ramsey County Historical Society, and the Labor and Working Class History Association. The talk was moderated by William Jones, professor of history at the University of Minnesota. Here's Professor Jones.
In Workers on Arrival, you begin by noting a theme that is really central to the book, that the ways in which issues of class and issues of work have in some ways become more prominent in American political discourse. I think, you know, sort of coming out of the 2016 election, there's a lot of talk about working class voters, about the working class. I think actually, it struck me that in 2016, Donald Trump was the first presidential candidate in decades who actually used the term working class as opposed to middle class. But as you point out, the way in which it's framed is in a very narrow way, standing in for the working class, the white industrial workers, often in the sort of small town Midwest, displaced industrial from deindustrialization. I think you make a really important point that if we're going to think about the working class in the United States, the place to start is actually to think about black workers, right? That black workers have always been at the center of the story of work and class in the United States. And I wonder if you could talk about why you think that's important and how you try to do that in the book.
Yeah, thank you. This is a centerpiece of the book. Look, you know, when you write a book over a long period of time, the moments that you were writing in keep shifting, right? So that at one moment, it was Obama. When I was trying to finish the book and then trying to make sense of what it meant in the context of, you know, these various moments along the way when the book didn't quite make it. But then this Trump moment, 2016, it came at a time that I was still working to try to revamp the book into a book mainly about black workers. And so it struck me that as I was writing and uncovering this history of blacks as contributors to the development of the wealth of the nation, that here we are now in the early phases of the 21st century, and people are still dismissing much of the Black working class experience, and not just dismissing it or ignoring it, but distorting it, because there was a distortion embedded in the way these white workers were discussed. And that distortion had to do with distorting the work ethic, let's say, of the Black worker, so that Black workers were kind of shunted to the side. Even if they were recognized, they were recognized in a negative way. They don't have a great work ethic, but they want all these social welfare programs that provide the safety nets and so on. And so I felt that, you know, one of the things that this study needed to do was to speak to the idea that Black workers have been part of the U.S. working class from day one. And I wanted to also make the point that they were not only part of the rural enslaved proletariat, working in rice, sugar, tobacco, and later cotton, that from the beginning, they were part of this urban proletariat. And that Black working class was there at the making of these American cities, across transnational cities, the Dutch, the English, the French, the Spanish, all of these colonies that were carved out, built cities, employing Black workers in some capacity. That didn't mean the majority of them necessarily were Black, but they were a hugely important part of every urban construction. And over time, Black workers continued to be part of the development and maintenance of these cities. And so that was one part of the story, is to bring the story in the early period out of this. It's important that we recognize the rural contribution, because that is pivotal. It's the most important thing. It's the way, you know, racialized capitalist development emerged out of these plantations, where Black people were fueling the wealth of the nation, and they were fueling the wealth of the Western world. Industrialization in England relied on this Black workforce, cotton textiles, as a sort of a front runner in industrial development. And of course, the Northern United States, claiming over time to be a freer place, also benefited over time from this enslaved labor. So I wanted to bring those stories together, but mainly because those other stories were being told in all kinds of ways, I wanted to underscore this urban context.
You mentioned synthesizing existing work, and it's a remarkable synthesis in the way in which you tell this really sweeping story, but then you really dig down into the detail and the lives of people at work and their lives in cities across the United States. It's really remarkable. It seems that a lot of what you do, it really anticipated, and I think in some of the points that were made by the 1619 Project, which was published in the same year, I believe later, okay, but emphasized the centrality of enslaved Africans to the economic and the political formation of what would become the United States. I think you do that really beautifully in the sort of the really fine-grained detail of description. I'll read one section. African people helped to build and service the colonial city, not only as general laborers and household and domestic workers, but as skilled craftsmen and craftswomen. Yeah. And the way in which I think another thing that you do that I think is really profound and useful is the way in which you call out the authors that you're drawing on and the other scholars that you're drawing on.
Okay.
It seems that one of the question that comes out of that in terms of touching on some of the controversy that was raised by the 1619 Project, I wonder if you could talk more about just the impact of enslaved African people on the country economically, but also politically in terms of the political institutions of the United States.
Yeah, I think that's an important question. The political part for this, I call this period before the Civil War, the pre-industrial age, But I really try to pay attention to the colonial pre-revolutionary period. What was that moment like for Black workers in America? And I think one of the major points I try to make is that in the politics of the colonial era, especially the politics of the late colonial era, there was a good deal of interaction between enslaved Blacks and to some extent small numbers of free Blacks and white workers, who some indentured servants and later just free wage earning white work. And so that Crispus Attucks is a symbolic figure that captures this ideal that the generator of the American Revolution came from below, from these multiracial, radicalized working classes, and that Black people were part of that, an integral part of that. So the revolution itself involved Black people on the ground and in the struggle to wrest this country from the British colonial empire. And so I think that, and Black people, although the revolution failed them in terms of emancipation and freedom and equality and rights and all of that, it situated them ideologically, and they continue to be a part of the economy. So their work was an important component of America's development going forward. And so they leverage their position in the economy to really push the ideals of the revolution and to really place America on notice that it had to move forward and finish that revolution. And until it addresses the issue of slavery and the enslavement of African people, then it is only a partial revolution. And I think what we begin to see is that Black people gradually put pressure on the state and on the states to liberate and create a more democratic, multiracial society. And so you see the rise in the years after the American Revolution of a free Black population that eventually amounts to about 500,000 free people of color by the time this Civil War. But this is one way in which Black people put a wedge into that system and really highlighted the contradiction between a nation professing to be, you know, a place of democratic freedom and at the same time suppressed an important part of the population. And I think the whole struggle for the democratization of America had a great center within the Black working class over the course of the early 19th century. And so the abolitionist movement, Black people would be at the forefront of forging an abolitionist movement. And they were also at the forefront of saying to the American Colonization Society, no, we're not leaving. We're going to fight it out here. And we're going to struggle against the effort to repatriate free people of color, of course, and leave enslaved people in bondage. And so there, I don't know if that's getting at all that you want to get at, but I think that's part of what shaped the early nation. It put the nation on notice that there was some work to be done and that Black people were going to be part of any progressive movement designed to rectify that injustice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I think that's the theme that comes out really starkly in the book, the sort of relationship or the dialectic between oppression and exploitation on one hand and the agency of working people, and the way in which Black workers really in very profound ways shaped the country moving forward. I want to bring in some people from the audience and some questions from the audience that I think Anne has been collecting.
Okay.
Yes. Emily has a question. Thinking about Will's connection between workers on arrival and what's missing from discussions today, working class identity. Joe, could you speak a bit about domestic labor and its place in stories told by or about Black workers?
Domestic workers are a major thread, integrally woven into the story of the Black working class. One of the things, this will underscore it, in most of the cities that I talk about in the book, from the colonial era through the late antebellum period, especially by the early 19th century. Black women were the predominant population. They outnumbered men, and in some cases quite significantly. And so the ideal of a pre-industrial working class has to incorporate, which I tried to do, this notion that working class was pretty occupationally diverse, and it included men and women, and to some extent children, because once these Black, let's say, once enslaved people, their numbers increased, once free Blacks started to increase, employers didn't waste much time putting these children to work, especially in household service, young boys, young girls. And so the household sector is very important. And that's one reason why women became such a predominant part of the population, is because these slave owners, artisans, as well as commercial people, they were looking for a way to help their wives. This is the period where economic historians talk about white women, especially elite women, feeling that they don't want to do this work anymore, and that is not fitting for the wife of a Republican and a free, independent man to have to do this drudgery. And so they were beginning to think of ways to offload all of this work onto another class of workers. And African Americans and poor whites were those workers that took up the slack and started to do all of this drudgery. Now, some scholars or some contemporary people even may have believed that these elites wanted Black servants so that they could serve their bodies, like they gonna cut their hair and they'll make their bath water and they'll help dress them and all of that, sort of this grooming kind of. But no, in all of these households, we know that these women were doing the hard labor. They were put to work scrubbing floors, polishing furniture, and tending to children, doing the whole work. So yes, household service, a centerpiece. And these women were very much, I don't want to usurp all the time, but household service also introduced early on this exploitation of women, both sexually and economically. And that's another thread that runs through this story. But they were essential parts of enriching the economy, enriching the people who owned them.
How has the Black working class reconstituted itself in different historical eras? And how might understanding this process help us to understand what is going on today between the descendants of enslaved Africans and recent immigrants from the African continent?
Okay, very good question. Will already mentioned that I talk about both so-called general labor, or what is sometimes called common labor, that Black people worked in the, and also what's sometimes called unskilled labor. They worked in these basic tasks. They lifted a lot, they dug ditches, they cleaned, they transported things. But there was, from the beginning, a segment of that early Black working class that was skilled workers. And some historians have suggested that by the time you get to the late 18th century through about the early 19th century, there's a moment in there where skilled Black artisans became more prominent in the development of these cities. And there was a kind of a golden age of the Black artisan, enslaved Black artisans for the most part, but then to some extent free Blacks. But free Blacks as artisans competing with slaves had a hard time. Some of them had to just slip out of the artisan class once they became free and couldn't compete with the. But during that time, employers, and let's just say slave owners, artisans, commercial people, especially artisans, and they trained these African people in carpentry, blacksmithing, and a variety, cabinet maker, a variety of skill craft, brick masonry, in order to enhance their value and to really increase their margin or profit. Now, about the 1820, this so-called golden age of the Black artisan nearly disappeared by the onset of the Civil War. And one factor in that process of, and this is a case in which the Black working class was reconfigured downward as these artisans were pushed out. And a factor in that were these millions of immigrants coming over from Ireland, especially, and Germany. Over 3 million, I think close to 4 million, between the end of the Revolution and the onset of the Civil War. And W.E.B. Du Bois wrote in detail about this process in Philadelphia. And he talks about how the Black artisan was pushed more and more to the wall by the 1820s and 1830s. And so that by 1860, that Black artisan class was only a fraction of its former self. At that point, you see in the rhetoric of Black people who commented on their own condition, they worried that they were becoming, quote, a race of servants. Mm. Now, Martin Delaney, a migrant from Virginia to Pittsburgh, he declared that it's no disgrace for people to work and make a living as servants, but a whole race of servants, he said, was a degradation to that people. And so that by the beginning of the Civil War, during the 1850s, all kinds of crises, African-Americans were beginning to despair. And the thing about it is that crisis not only affected Blacks at the artisan level, it reached down into certain other kinds of jobs that Black people had achieved. One of those jobs was the barber trade. Right after the Civil War, white men said, I'm free. Barbering is a servile occupation. I'm not going to do it unless I have to, maybe something like that. But Black, they opened an opening for the Black barber, for the Black population. Free Blacks entered the barber trade in rising numbers after the American Revolution and after white workers associated with the revolution started to distance themselves from that trade. Now, that was one of the jobs that the immigrants from Germany and Ireland were not opposed to taking. And so they started to take some of these most lucrative jobs at the lower end of the occupational structure so that Black workers were really squeezed at both the upper end artisan and the lower end where they involved in barbering and in some transport trade, some transport situation.
The final question, someone says that they would like to hear Professor Trotter talk about scholarly trends regarding the role of Black elites and class tensions within the African-American community. In an earlier period, lots of scholars were critical of folks like Booker T. Washington. Yet in recent years, a number of scholars have written about him and those like him in a more favorable light. I see this as a part of a broader tendency to marginalize labor history and class more generally. I would love to hear your thoughts.
I know that when historians write, there's some back and forth. And that debate between Washington and Du Bois, as a labor historian, I've always felt that we invested it maybe in too much in that debate between those elites. On the ground, Black people were forging opinions about how to deal with their own lives. In some cases, the debates reflected some of the ideals that are percolating from the bottom. And so I know the person is saying that today there's been a resurgence, and I don't have the examples in hand about the resurgence, but I would say that we need to keep our focus clear when we're dealing with these debates between these elites. And I believe that even on the ground back in the day, there was ambiguity, for example, in the way that some working people responded to Washington versus Du Bois. And so it was never a foregone conclusion that Du Bois would triumph and become the predominant figure. And so I would like to just add that there's a little bit of a, I think, margin in there that we have to consider.
This was a great turnout. Everyone stay warm and stay safe. And we'll be seeing you sometime, somewhere virtually, and maybe eventually even face to face. So thank you very much.
I'm Rick Smith. And this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1974. That was the day that workers at Ferra Manufacturing finally ratified its first contract. Workers went on strike in May of 1972, demanding union recognition. Owner Willie Ferra had said he'd rather die than have his company go union. It was said that he rode his bicycle through the plant screaming, "Work faster! Work faster!" Management had imposed increasingly unattainable production quotas that bred dangerous working conditions until finally the workers had had enough. The organizing drive to bring the American Clothing Workers of America began in 1969. It spread to 5 plants throughout El Paso, Texas. Workers often met in secret. Though male cutters had initially sought out representation with the ACWA, the workforce was overwhelmingly comprised of Mexican-American women. The workers staged a walkout in March of 1972, and many were fired on the spot. By May of that year, the firing of workers at the San Antonio plant for union activity prompted a strike. Declared an unfair labor practice strike, the AFL-CIO began a national boycott campaign of Ferra products. The ACWA organized public support and strike relief. Women strikers embarked on a nationwide speaking tour as part of the Justice at Ferra Strikers Committee to build the boycott and public support. By early 1974, the NLRB ordered the workers to be reinstated and union organizing to go forward. The contract included wage increases, seniority rights and job security, and grievance procedures. But long-term lessons of the strike proved that the work of organizing could never stop with winning recognition and a first contract. Workers continued to battle for years against quotas, firings, and weak representation in a historically right-to-work state.
That's it for this week's edition of Labor History Today. You can subscribe to LHT on your favorite podcast app. And even better, if you like what you hear, and we hope you do, please like it in your podcast app and pass it along. Our thanks to the Eastside Freedom Library for permission to use the History Book Club virtual talk with Professor Trotter, which was co-sponsored by the University of Minnesota's Department of History, the Ramsey County Historical Society, and the Labor and Working Class History Association. The Eastside Freedom Library, whose mission is to inspire solidarity, advocate for justice, and work toward equity for all, has its home in a historic Carnegie Library building in St. Paul, Minnesota. You can find out more about the library and their upcoming programs available online at eastsidefreedomlibrary.org. Labor History in Two is a partnership between the Illinois Labor History Society and the Rick Smith Show, a labor-themed radio show out of Pennsylvania. Our music today is John Lee Hooker's Messin' Round with the Blues. Labor History Today is produced by the Metro Washington Council's Union City Radio and the Kalmanovitz Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor at Georgetown University. The Labor History Today team includes Ben Blake, Patrick Dixon, Leon Fink, Sherry Lincoln, Joe McCartan, Evan Papp, Jessica Pozak, and Alan Weirdak. For Labor History Today, this has been Chris Garlock. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and healthy, but do keep making history, and see you next time.
Yeah, messing with the blues. I got a feeling, the blue feeling.